This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Law, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jane Richards, and today I have the great pleasure of interviewing Associate Professor Anna Erickson of Monash University about her co-edited book, Neurodisability and the Criminal Justice System, Comparative Therapeutic Responses. She is a co-editor with Gay T. Lansdell, Bernadette J. Saunders, and herself, of course. And it was published by Edward Elgar Publishing in 2021. I'll let Professor Erickson introduce herself. So without further ado, Professor Anna Erickson, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Jane. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. Now, just to get us started, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to edit this book.
Sure. So I'm a professor of criminology here at Monash, and I've been interested in the responses to crime since my PhD, which I finished back in 2007. And in 2010, I met with Gay and Bernadette, who are my co-editors, and we had similar kind of interests around responses to crime, and particularly in relation to vulnerable populations. So we applied for a research grant that we got that looked at the infringement system here in Victoria. This is a system that deals with fines of not having a ticket or being drunk in the park or something like that. And we looked in particular at vulnerable populations, which in this context is those with mental illness, drug and alcohol dependencies, homeless and so on and so forth. And they often overlap and become entangled in the justice system. We also learned that a significant cohort of that group had acquired brain injuries of some description. So that was kind of how that started, and an interest in that and why that group is kind of gets stuck, you know, entangled in the system more than other people and end up in prison more than other people and so on and so forth. So we applied for another research grant that we got looking at adults with acquired brain injury in Victoria, in Australia. And later on, another grant looking at young people, so those under 18 and kind of those trajectories. So there are those two projects that kind of underpin this book. The term neurodisability was something that's kind of just been emerging in the last couple of years, really, as an umbrella term to talk about not just people with acquired brain injuries, but with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, FASD, other cognitive disabilities, and including intellectual disability that's slightly more attention to. So we wanted to kind of broaden the term and see who are these people, how are they involved in the criminal justice system, and what happens on the international stage, because people are the same everywhere, but the responses to them differ depending on culture and politics and so on and so forth. So that's the kind of background. And I think also really wanting to look for at least suggestions for solutions or how to make things better. Like, that was a real aim for this one, as opposed to just describing the problem. We want people who work in this field to then say, how do we fix this?
Yeah, and I do think that comes through in the book. It's, as you say, it's not just a description of all these different issues, but in fact, you do offer solutions and suggestions for reform and the sort of practical issues that people do deal with on the ground. And I found that really interesting, the sort of contrasting, and we'll get into this, but the sort of contrasting issues that people face, for example, if they do have fetal alcohol syndrome compared to intellectual disabilities, compared to juveniles, as an example. So now, can you tell me a little bit about what is the prevalence then of people with neurodisabilities in the criminal justice system?
Yes. I think that the way I might approach this is to focus more exclusively on acquired brain injury first, because the prevalence will increase. I think it might be important for listeners to understand what we're talking about and what kind of how people have acquired brain injury and what that means. I think they will save us time, but a lot of those themes reoccur in relation to different kinds of neurodisabilities. So an acquired brain injury refers to any damage inflicted on the brain after birth, and it can be caused by a range of factors, including head trauma, stroke, disease, infection, or substance abuse. A lot of people make a distinction between acquired brain injury and traumatic brain injury, but the traumatic brain, the TBI, is literally just a violent blow to the head or a head injury that is traumatic in its nature from a medical point of view, but that falls under the umbrella term of acquired brain injuries. The effects of an ABI can be described as both cognitive and physical, emotional, and an impact on independent functioning. But the symptoms vary considerably depending on the individual and the severity and location of their injury and how the injury happened in the first place, which makes it challenging to diagnose, to identify, and to respond to. Like, there's no one-size-fits-all when we're talking about neurodisabilities. It has to be an individual focus. And symptoms can include slurred speech, loss of taste and smell, sensory impairment, pain and fatigue, issues with memory, concentration, problem solving, all those kinds of things. And we'll see how that impacts, I think, on the involvement in the justice system. Other things like aggression, irritability, impulsiveness, lack of judgment, they also come under this, both for the ABI, but also for many of the other neurodisabilities, which makes people more prone to maybe coming to the attention of authorities and then to police, and then the cycle begins. Quite often these or behaviours can be misinterpreted. One person we spoke to, he wrote an article about that. He said, "I'm not drunk, I have an ABI," and he had been in and out of prison, but he also had an acquired brain injury, which made his sense of balance was really bad, so he fell over literally quite often if he didn't have his cane, and was picked up by police for being drunk. And then trying to explain that it's a brain injury is not always easy to do in those circumstances. Another challenge, I think, is that they often coexist with other things like drug and alcohol abuse, mental illness, and so on and so forth, which all makes people more prone to have another brain injury, because of all these things. And because you can't see it, so it's described as a hidden disability, because people can have it without, unless you have some of these obvious symptoms, you can't see it. You can't see that someone don't understand what you're saying, or they can't. Then maybe the memory is not as good as it should be, and you can't see that. So it's often missed or misdiagnosed, which is a serious issue that I think all the chapters in the book deals with. Prevalence. Acquired brain injury in the general population is around 2%. In prison, we're estimating up to 40%. And when we add the other kinds of neurodisability, like FASD and other kinds of trauma, some estimate up to 80%, especially for juvenile offenders or young prisoners. Maybe slightly less in adult prison, but it is a massive issue, basically.
Yeah, it's surprising, and it is very concerning that you know, there is this much higher correlation of people in prisons with, for example, acquired brain injuries and other neurodisabilities compared to the general population. So one must wonder what is causing this dissonance. I want to move to the next chapter in the book, which is titled Neurodisability, Criminal Law Doctrine That Is Not Pure Insanity. And it's by Amanda C. Pustelnik. I hope I've pronounced that correctly. I guess insanity is one of those ones where people think they know about it, and it gets a lot more media attention comparatively. So I'm wondering then, can you tell me about any sort of coincidences and divergences between neurodisability and insanity?
Yes, and I think the point that Amanda is making in her chapter is that they are not the same. Neurodisability is not insanity. The problem is that there is no legal defense available for people with a neurodisability that is kind of enshrined in law, but there is one for insanity. Yeah. So from a lawyer's point of view, that's what you would use if you can, because that would then, you know, explain the behavior and particularly taken into account in relation to sentencing, perhaps. So basically people who have a neurodisability are not insane. In the legal sense of the word, and I think we should be really careful to think about them as such. And she talks really interestingly in her book about the kind of faulty brain. I know from a criminology point of view, people look for like the criminal gene. Of course, there aren't one. Yeah, people, just certain behaviors are criminalized over time and place that differs. So the crime is whatever law says it is. So if we go too far here and say, so maybe a acquired brain injury or someone who's born with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, if they are somehow faulty, I think we're going down a really dangerous route when it comes to the legal responses. So I think it requires a really a nuanced approach. But maybe there should be a defense or something in the legal system that recognizes neurodisability. In a much more explicit way, and particularly, I think, in relation to sentencing, as opposed to, it's not about excusing behaviors, it's about understanding why people do what they do. And I think, as you cover in a few of these chapters, that the criminal justice system uses punishment as a way to change behaviors. That's the aim, yeah? It fails for so many reasons. But if you are unable to change your behavior because you have a neurodisability, of course it is ineffective, but it's also almost cruel and unusual, yeah, to punish people for something they cannot help but do.
Yeah, and that makes sense, especially considering neurodisabilities may be sort of a permanent, an ongoing part of someone, and it's a lack of support and accommodation which may cause this sort of criminal, seemingly criminal conduct, which is sort of wouldn't otherwise be if they had those supports. So then I guess moving to the next chapter, which is a public laws model for cognitive communication risk. And that's by Joseph Wolzeslek. Can you tell me about the kinds of disorders that put individuals at risk for cognitive communication risks? And how did these manifest in terms of the disadvantages that certain individuals face when coming into contact with the criminal justice system?
Yes. Well, basically, the whole range of neurodisabilities covered in the book would fall under that concern. So that would include acquired brain injury, addiction, intellectual disability, FASD, as well as mental health disorders. I think they all impact cognitive mechanisms, such as working memory, processing speed, and executive functioning. And I think the interface, the justice system is really complex, at the best of times. And for most people, it has a particular language and a particular culture that most people don't understand unless you've been trained in it. So if you then have a cognitive disability that makes it more difficult to process information and understand instructions and maybe speak in it or express yourself in the way you would like to, that obviously disadvantages someone, to a significant degree across that whole system.
Yeah, and go on.
No, I think the point before as well, that these things are often invisible, yeah, so you can't see them. Which is why, testing and It's incredibly important because what underpins the kind of revolving door to the prison that we speak about in the book, that people go in and out because, you know, they have no other option but.
Yeah, I mean, I think the legal system can be difficult for lawyers to navigate, notwithstanding someone who's may have a disability that is invisible to others. It's sort of the mind boggles how complex it must be trying to navigate that system without familiarity of it. So then drawing these sort of two chapters together, the chapter with relation to insanity and also this one, put forward a public health framework with regard to the impact of neurodisability in the operation of criminal law and those that come into contact with it. So the first chapter focuses on insanity and, as you said, the differences between insanity and neurodisability. While this chapter looks at the barriers to free and open cognitive communication, can you tell me a little bit more about the idea of a public health model in the context of neurodisability?
Yes, I think the public health model is something particularly within chronology that we keep arguing for, because a lot of these behaviours become criminalised. The people who end up in prison, yeah, these are not the rich people who had a car accident because they have a good lawyer and they can argue their way in out of this. People, it intersects with disability, other kinds of disability, with poverty, with disadvantage across a range of factors. Which means, and as I said, if you can't change your behavior, then the criminal law and the threat of punishment is ineffective. Then it's ridiculous to use it. Yeah. So if you want to change behavior, you have to do something else. So I think a public health approach is the way to go. Like this is not about crime; it's about health. And from an early age, I mean, we talk to people who were now, you know, repeat offenders, but who had been victims of domestic violence as children. One man we spoke to whose father had hit them over the head with a hammer and had a traumatic brain injury as a consequence, but also obviously the trauma of living in that stressful environment contributes to your brain not developing properly, which we speak about in other chapters. And to have like a criminal approach to that person's behavior, it's not helping anyone. It's just creating more victimization and trauma and a whole generation of kind of institutionalized people. So that's the argument, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, and that makes sense because I think what the criminal justice system does is it focuses on the legal issue and solves the legal issue in isolation from the other sort of Luke Clements describes it as these systems of collective injustice, which can exacerbate disadvantage. And so it does certainly make more sense to approach it from a criminological perspective of a public health model. Another way these sort of issues have been understood or at least analysed are from the perspective of the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities. And the next chapter actually relates to this. It's by Penelope Weller, and it's called Access to Justice in the CRPD, an Australian Perspective. So she writes, especially with regards to people with neurodisabilities and acquired brain injuries, analysed through the lens of the CRPD. Can you tell me a little bit about what makes Australia unique and what are some of the commonalities that can be applied more broadly?
Well, I think this is my non-scientific view, but I think what makes Australia unique is that we've been quite rubbish at adopting and implementing human rights instruments across a range of areas, yeah, and you know, recent examples around refugees and Indigenous people and confinement of young people. And I think, as Penelope refers to in her chapters, it says like the understanding of issues in relation to rights of persons with disability in Australia is emerging. And I think that's an accurate description. It needs a lot more work, but I think the commonalities that Australia has with other countries is the barriers to access to justice. And there's a list of these things in this book, and I don't know if I want to quote some of this, but it speaks to all of these issues, I think. So things like a greater likelihood of incarceration, including in circumstances in which charges and arrests were unwarranted, family violence victims being evicted for reasons that are not their fault, such as damage to the rental home by the perpetrator, inability to resolve debt and fines and so on and so forth, people remaining at risk of harm, violence, exploitation, families being split when children are unnecessarily removed, and so on and so forth. There's a range of barriers, and different chapters cover a different of them. But this is something that we have in common with everyone else that we've been speaking to in this field. And that's the kind of immediate thing I think we need to address.
Yeah, and it is a huge problem. So moving to part two of the book, and I found this really interesting because it's not something that I'm familiar with at all. And it's about the needs of young people with neurodisabilities. So can you just, to sort of give a broad brush overview, what are some of the specific needs of young people with neurodisabilities when they come into contact with the criminal justice system?
Yes, well, I think the needs of young people in general is quite similar. Obviously, then with a disability, it becomes a lot worse. Some barriers will be systemic because they develop systemic procedural and cultural, for example. But systemic, it's a lack of coordination between different services, such as child welfare and protection, health, education and justice. They all operate in silos very often, and children just bounce around between them. The procedural ones around the rigidity and the complexity of the system and what the judges wear and how they speak and so on and so forth. And the kind of cultural barriers about the understanding, I think, of these issues. So that there would be a range of them. And obviously then with the symptoms that we talked about before of neurodisability, it becomes incredibly complex. And I think just by way of illustration, and I was, when I reread this book the last day, there is on one of the pages here a table that just lists the overrepresentation of young people. This is in the UK. And so people with learning or intellectual disability, this is page 102 in the book, the prevalence amongst general population is 2-4%. In young people in custody is 23-32%. Fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is between 0.1-5% in the general population and up to 11-21%. And I think in Australia that will be doubled, particularly in Western Australia and Northern Territory. Communication impairment, general population 5-7%, in custody 60-90%. On ADHD, between 2 and 9 compared to 12. So I think that paints a pretty clear picture of how the system fails young people with neurodisabilities.
Yeah, there's obviously some disjuncture between the lack of community support and the prevalence of young people with neurodisabilities who are in custody, which of course itself can have long-term, lifelong implications for those children and their development. So then how do we go about dismantling some of the barriers to justice for children affected by neurodisabilities? This is a chapter that Frances Sheehan, Nathan Hughes, Hugh Williams and Prathibha Chittasabhan write about. And so I'm interested, just to start with, what are the various points of contact that children with neurodisabilities tend to encounter with the criminal justice process? And how does this manifest in a denial of equal access to justice?
Mm. So some of the barriers we talked about, they're procedural and cultural and so on and so forth. But the point of contact for children, and this is very similar to the research we see here in Australia, happens early on. Often the children we see in prison and custody, yeah, they're often removed from families at an early age, or they run away because of family violence in the home. So they're already disadvantaged from that stage. Some would end up in a good kind of care situation. Many do not. The care homes and the things that we have in Australia and similar in the UK are not fit for purpose, and further trauma, physical, mental, sexual abuse, more violence, and so on and so forth. The problem there, and same in the UK and other countries, that when children act up, as they say, challenging behavior in those situations, instead of seeing that as a result of the trauma that they bring with them, those people call the police, like staff would call the police, because they don't know how to manage them. And it's incredibly difficult to manage, and especially when you have lots of children with those kinds of trauma. So the police is called, and then this is what we talk about, disability and disadvantage being criminalized, because that's when they then, yeah, so that's how it begins. And then it's really hard to get out of that system. There's research here in Australia by Susie Baidawi, who talks about crossover children. These are the kids who end up in care and then go to juvenile prison and then to adult prison. And they're just stuck for the rest of their lives in this system. And they all come from backgrounds of trauma and very often neuro disabilities. So, yeah, it's not a happy story.
No, and it touches on what you mentioned before, and what one of the later chapters in the book is about, the revolving door of prison and custody for people with neuro disabilities. And so the next chapter is on trauma, but I think you've answered a lot of those questions. That's a neuro disability and trauma in children and young people in contact with the law. So perhaps we'll move on to the chapter following, and that's about how because you've touched on the barriers to equal access to justice, and how some of those are systemic and procedural. There's a lack of coordination between the sort of different services. So then let's talk about protecting vulnerable child defendants in England and Wales, because this was quite an interesting case study. And that there was a chapter on that by Shauneen Lamb and Catherine Hollingsworth. So in this chapter, the authors argue that conflating children with a broader category of vulnerable defendants has caused children to be written out of rights. Can you speak a little more to this point?
Yes, a little, but not too much, because I'm not a legal expert, so people who want they have to read the chapter. But it's trying to look for solution and to say that vulnerable defendants, that could be anyone. Yes, it could be an adult who is vulnerable because of a mental health disorder or a neuro disability. But children are unique. And I think the previous chapters around trauma and so on, and Nathan Hughes and his colleagues, it's really interesting. I'm a bit of a nerd when it comes to this kind of neuropsychology stuff, but about brain development and what when the brain develops in different areas and what trauma at those ages might do. So when it comes to children in front of the courts, to understand that their brain development, that and the 10-year-old cannot understand or plan in the way. So even as in that particular chapter about the James Bulger case and Robert Thompson and John Venables, who were nine, yeah, at the time they did it, but they turned 10 before they went to court. But they were tried as adults, which obviously was a massive problem from a legal point of view. But the way they were presented in the press and you know what I mean, they were seen as the devil's spawn, quote unquote, and as evil. Like there was no, and since then, very little recognition of their own perhaps victimization and the lack of maturity. Like everyone focused on the horrific acts that they did, and they were horrific. But that also then kind of did not allow for people to ask the questions that should have been asked about why do children like this do this, and you know, how can we help children as opposed to how can we punish them? So I think that chapter deals with some of those really complex questions.
Mm. And it was interesting when they wrote about those cases when they went to the European Court of Human Rights, and it was held that notwithstanding that the proceedings were made more child-friendly, that as children they were still unable to effectively participate in the trial. I mean, it does make sense, because it's intimidating for an adult person without a neuro disability, even a lawyer, to go to court. So it's difficult to imagine for a child who's treated like an adult what the experience would be and how it would be possible to make it more child friendly and actually get a better outcome in terms of justice. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's such a strange, I mean, the court is such a strange environment. And, you know, we see it on TV and it's interesting. But as someone who is there as the accused, you are not even allowed to speak. You know, you can't, someone speaks on your behalf and you rely on, and they speak in a language and vocabulary that we don't understand. And I know that from our students that, you know, they have to go to court for a day and do the court report. And they're like, couldn't hear what they were saying. I didn't understand what they were saying. And it happened so quickly. In 10 minutes, there was the next case. And like, it's a very particular environment. So for a child or someone with a disability or someone who has both of those things, yeah, as a young person, disability, it's almost impossible.
Yeah, it's difficult to comprehend. So then one group of children who do have neurodisabilities and appear more frequently than others, as you just said, looking at the statistics, so 11 to 21% of young people in custody in England and Wales have fetal alcohol syndrome disorder, and it's possibly double in Western Australia or the Northern Territory. So turning to the chapter on that, how does fetal alcohol syndrome disorder influence an individual as they move through the criminal justice process?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, yeah. So it's estimated, I think, in Australia here, it's 10 to 40 times higher amongst the populations within correctional and psychiatric care and special education care settings, yeah, compared to the general population. I think both of where they're involved and the kind of challenges they face, I think, is kind of the same answer there. But so some of the challenges we talked about before is similar because it falls under the umbrella term of neurodisability. But in general, so individuals with FASD often have problems with memory, attention, language and communication, cognition, understanding social rules and expectations, regulating emotions, abstract thinking, decision-making, reasoning, impulsivity, understanding cause and effect, and motor skills. And these are the kind of primary deficits that these children are born with, yeah? We can always have very complex and quite devastating impacts on their lives, but they often then intersect with disadvantage, poverty in Australia, racism, I would argue. But also then that leads to poor mental health, substance abuse, school failure, unemployment, and then you're in the justice system. And that's something that we see in Australia, in particular in relation to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander populations. And they're overrepresented in general, but particularly in juvenile prisons, and a very high percentage of them seems to have a FASD diagnosis.
So then what we've got on one hand, we've had these really interesting case studies of from the perspective of people who come into contact with the criminal justice system who do have neurodisabilities, both adults and children. And then on the other hand, the next part of the book turns and looks at the responses to neurodisability within the criminal justice system. I found this really interesting to sort of think about because often lawyers think they know a lot. So I really liked this chapter on titled What Do Lawyers Really Know About Neurodisability? Confusion, Obfuscation and Dereliction of Duty. And that was by you and the other two co-editors, Gay Lansdell, Bernadette Saunders, and also Rebecca Bunn. So what do lawyers know about neurodisability?
Not enough is the short answer. It's the people who do know, so different lawyers, yeah, but people who work in legal aid in particular, they know quite a lot because they are the ones who see these people the most because it intersects so strongly with disadvantage and poverty when it comes to justice involvement. But they would know, like as they say, like when someone walks into the office and speaks to them, they would just know that something is a little off. And that falls under the general kind of umbrella term then of neurodisability, but they don't know what it is. And no one can know unless they have a proper kind of neuropsychological evaluations, which is expensive. So unless it's a court-ordered one, the clients can't afford to pay for it and lawyers won't cover it. So they don't know enough about the how it presents, and that's again the hidden aspects of it for the ones who you can't see. And because you're trained in that particular system, how do you change the way you communicate with someone like that? How do you have to explain things differently? Perhaps you have to repeat things, you have to write them down. How do you support them? Maybe they need other kinds of support during the court proceedings that some jurisdictions have implemented. So there's a general lack, and law school don't teach it. Now we do here because we did the research. We told Monash you have to teach students about this because they will meet these people over and over again if you work within the criminal justice type area anyway.
That's interesting. So then I guess my next question is, and you've sort of already half answered it, but what should lawyers know? And do you have any recommendations? I think it's really innovative that they are being taught at Monash, because I certainly as an undergrad was not taught. And when I've taught criminal law, where I am now in Hong Kong, there's no contemplation that this is part of the curriculum.
Yeah, I think they should know, one, what it is, yeah, just definition. And the reason why they should know is because this group is so overrepresented. So if it wasn't, it wouldn't be so much of an issue, yeah? But because it's between, you know, 60 to 80% of people in prison with a neurodisability, it is incredibly important for them to do their job effectively. If they want to defend someone, particularly, yeah? I guess the challenge for law school is that people don't know what they're going to do when they finish, and maybe they want to work in business law, and they don't care about this. But, you know, as our job as educators to teach them things they don't need, they don't think they need, or that they, you know, but they might need it later. And so they need to, I mean, it's always a challenge. So if someone presents with it with an ABI that is completely invisible, and you can't actually, the behavior is not strange, like you can't see the cognitive processing, then it's very little you can do. And these people will fall through the net in different ways. But I think having a basic kind of, even like a little, you know, leaflet to like, this is what it is, these are the symptoms, these are the reasons for it, and also how they intersect. I think that's incredibly important with mental health and addiction, for example, because it's often misinterpreted as the addiction is the problem. That might actually just be the result of an underlying neurodisability or a tool of self-medication, for example. So, yes. And then they should know, I know we know here in Melbourne when we did the research, that to be well connected to support organisations in the community who can help these people outside of the very kind of narrow justice focus.
Yeah, so then that way the criminal justice isn't the trigger to accessing support and services. It's in the community to start with where people need it. That seems a lot more sensible approach, I think. And so then sort of giving a practical example, the next chapter was written by Magistrate Pauline Spencer, and it's called Towards Dignity, Better Court Pathways for People with Lived Experience of Acquired Brain Injury. Now, Magistrate Spencer gave a really interesting account of the ways that people with an acquired brain injury and neurodisability move through the court process. She gave a unique example, or perhaps, sorry, it's not unique, but she gives an account of a man named Joel who spends his day waiting in court for the mention of his charges. Now, Joel was charged with, and I think this picks up on what you said before about the sort of intersecting problems that people face. It's not just neurodisability, but there are other issues going on, for example, like poverty, access to social services, health, and a whole myriad of sorts of things. So coming back to the example, Joel was charged with breaking a window at a social security office because his income was cut off, and then he missed too many appointments. So he's at the court and he waits through lunchtime, and then he's hungry, but he's too embarrassed to say to anyone that he has no money for lunch. So what he does, he goes home because he has some bread there, but then he misses his mention and a warrant is issued for his arrest. He's later arrested, and because he's got previous charges for minor offences, he's held on remand. Now, he's really stressed because he's been homeless before and he's worried about losing this home that he's just secured. So when he finally appears before the magistrate, he's anxious, shifts in his chair, and he interrupts. I can't imagine this would go down particularly well in court. There's no reference made at all to his disability, and then he's sentenced to 2 months in jail. So now this exacerbates his stress because he will lose his home and he'll end up homeless all over again. Now, this court process seems to actually perpetrate discrimination against Joel rather than lending him any sort of assistance, and perpetrates his disadvantage. Can you tell me how typical Joel's experience might be and what could be done by way of reform?
It's very typical. This is, it's heartbreaking, you know, and there are people like Joel who they try to do the right thing and they try to follow instructions for people in authority and they fail all the time. And there's nothing they can do to change that. And we have magistrates like Pauline Spencer and others here who are just amazing in their job. And the magistrates, I think, have so much knowledge about this. And I think that's where the solution should start, because they really know what they're doing. So, yeah, very common, too common, yeah. And this is what we mean when we talk about the criminalization of disability and poverty and disadvantage, yeah. So two things here that in terms of reform and that we mentioned some of that in this chapter, and Pauline does, and we have some in our other research. One is within the judicial system and the other part is connected to it. So I think the specific court-based possible solution first. So in Victoria, which is Melbourne, Australia, where we do this research, there are two initiatives that seem to be working really well when dealing with people in court who present with complex and intersectional problems like the ones we discussed today. The first one is CISP, that stands for Court Integrated Services Program. It runs from all the kind of mainstream magistrates' court and provide case-based individual support for a person who's on bail, which is the key thing here, yeah, which includes then a neurological screening and assessment and referral and so on and so forth. So that's been really good, but it's limited in terms of you have to be on bail, so you can't have a serious offence, you have to have an address where they can reach you, and people who are homeless, they don't, so they don't qualify, and so on, so some people, too many, fall outside of that. The other one is called the Assessment and Referral Court, or the ARC list. Pauline Spencer works in one of those. We have a few others. And these are simply amazing. And we were invited to sit in on quite a few of these and look how they operate. And it's a pre-sentence program. So it's not about guilt or innocence. It's about what do we now do to help this person and to find different solution. This is a program for people with lived experience of mental and cognitive impairment. And they receive then coordinated service in accordance with an individual support plan. And that plan is developed in collaboration with the participants so they understand what it is, and with expert assistance of a clinical and a case managed team. And it's really quite fabulous. And the evaluations show that the reoffending rate is reduced significantly for the group that is on this initiative. And of course, we keep them out of prison and further harm, yeah? The challenge is, which relates to the more general issue, is that there's not enough community-based support for people. So we need more services to link them into. It's one thing to know what their needs are, but if no one is working in that space, or they might be full, or they're waiting for the next funding round, like these things should be funded on a continuous basis as opposed to year on year, depending on what government, you know, is in charge. So the community part is incredibly important. And the knowledge they have combined with the magistrate could basically fix this, you know what I mean? I mean, prison is so expensive, yeah, to send someone, and it's $100,000 per year to have one person in high security. And if that money can be used in community-based kind of support that is individually tailored, because the individual aspect is crucial, yeah, because everyone will have a different presentation of this, of their disability, then I think we can have a massive impact. But that takes a bit of, you know, political will. and it doesn't, I guess... correspond with some of the here in Australia, at least I think a lot of Anglophone countries, with this tough on crime approach. Yeah, looks at being too nice and cuddly, but if we are serious about reducing reoffending and reducing, you know, intergenerational trauma and victimization, these kind of things is they need to be done.
Yeah, no, that's interesting, because a lot of this law and order sort of politics actually is propagated under the banner of like protecting community safety and doing it in the interests of the public. And yet if this is one solution to redirect resources, then it does seem like it would actually better protect the community. So yeah, it seems like, as you say, it does need political will, but it does seem like a solution that would improve the lives of these people who come into contact with the criminal justice system. And it's sort of trying to prevent what you talk about in the next chapter about the revolving prison door. And you say that it's an international problem viewed through an Australian lens. And again, you've written this chapter with your other co-editors. So can you tell me, you have mentioned it already, but can you tell me more about this revolving prison door and what is also unique about the Australian context?
Yeah. So it's as we said, people who come into contact with the justice system because of their neurodisability, and then as the example of Joel, they're unable to navigate their way out of it. Some people with some kinds of neurodisability function quite well in prison, depending on the prison, because it's a very structured environment. You're told what to do, you're told when to get up, what to eat, where to go, here's your medication. You don't have to think too much on your own. But when they are then released and they have none of that structure, they fail really quickly and they then reoffend. And obviously because they have an underlying, brain injury or cognitive disability, they will repeat the same offending, like getting on the train without a ticket or even being involved in violence and so on and so forth. So, and that's the revolt. Yeah, so that's reincarcerated over and over again. And we can't kind of break that cycle with the current approach that we have. Yeah.
Yeah, and just the idea that, for example, someone can be in prison, and I know it is really common, for something like riding a train without a ticket just seems to sort of undermine the principles of criminal justice, such as like punishment and deterrence and rehabilitation. It just sort of, there is this huge disjuncture. So then in prison, you've just mentioned that some people actually might do better in the sense that there's routine, but then they end up back there. What are some of the additional challenges that a person with an ABI might face once they are in prison? And can you suggest ways that might provide better accommodation?
Yes, I think the two sides to that. One is people who continue to offend while they're in prison, and other ones become victims. Yeah, depending on their disability. So if you have a problem with impulse control and aggressiveness and those kind of behavior, you're going to be in fights every day for your sentence. That's the whole environment is geared up for that. But if you have difficulty managing your emotions or personal boundaries, a lot of people are victimized physically, sexually, socially throughout the sentence, and some end up in protective custody, which is really hard to get out of as well. So all of those kind of more extreme things. But there's also, I think, in looking at solutions, how that can be met. I think staff training is crucial, and we're not doing it well in Australia. Staff don't understand necessarily. Some do, who have experience, who work for a long time. Some don't, and some don't care. They just want people from road to A to B. And so if someone misses a meeting, you get penalised for that, yeah? But they just didn't remember because they can't remember the time. So there needs to be, staff needs to be better trained to deal with the complex individuals who are in prison in contemporary society. This is not the turnkeys that they used to be, or the kind of honest crooks, as people refer to them still. There are so many with these issues that they need training in that, and they don't get that. In terms of physical solutions, and this is my area of research, so I can talk about this all day, but even ways to redesign and build prisons slightly differently, like the accommodation. So at the moment, like a wing or a unit is between 36 or 72 people, depending on single or double bunking. And we see from some of the comparative work that I do in Norway, for example, that the smaller wings, when you have 12 people or even 6 people, work much, much, much better, both to manage for staff and for the people who live there. Some of prisons in Australia and Victoria, they changed the law in relation to people with intellectual disability. So they tend to live in these special units, but they are a minority of people with neurodisabilities in prison who live in mainstream. So staff training and a physical prison that is better equipped to deal with complex behaviours.
And so would you say then there's specific resource constraints within prison that hinder the opportunity of providing these sort of alternative accommodations, or is it an issue of resource reallocation? Is that something, like, I don't know if that's something you can comment on.
So the problem with, it's not about reallocation, but the problem is politics, that there is no political will to reallocate funds in that way that would better support prisoners and people with neuro disability in the ways that we've outlined. It's a tough on crime approach. Community safety is the buzzword, yeah, but I tend to ask people to rethink that the prison might offer short-term community safety while that particular person is locked up, if he or she now is actually dangerous, which many of them are not. But we need to think about long-term community safety, which will happen when these people are released. Secondly, the people who are in prison, they are also our community, yeah? They're also citizens. What about their safety, which is also not thought about because we don't like being, you know, being nice to prisoners in this country. And it's not being nice, it's about being just, and I think, and about recognising individual circumstances. So the politics is lacking, the money isn't lacking. We're spending an enormous amount of money on building new prisons in all states and territories in Australia, building high security as opposed to low security, which keeps driving up incarceration and reoffending rates. So there are things that we can do without spending more money, but spending them differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And then so bringing all of these chapters together, what surprised you most about the research?
For me, I think, especially for the last project that we did, the number of children who experience serious trauma in early life and our society's failure to appropriately respond to that. I think it's tragic, but I think the numbers surprised me in that way. Less surprising, I guess, but always disappointing is Australia's approach for dealing with crime and social disorder by way of punishment. And as we said, the constant political argument for longer and harsher sentence instead of attention to the causes of crime and prevention. And like it goes in the too hard basket, and as opposed to kind of the justice reinvestment or public health or therapeutic jurisprudence type approaches that could be much more effective in reducing crime and reducing reoffending, that you would think should be the aim of the system as opposed to just punishing.
And so then what would you say are the next steps in terms of research and reform?
Well, I think I think all the chapters outline quite a few of those suggestions. So I think two things. One, I think it's up to other people now to pick whatever they are interested in and doing research where they are in these areas. And the second is for us and for other people in the space to better translate our findings into a format that is easily communicated to policy and those kind of stakeholders. So it's more the kind of direct impactful reform that we want to work on. And to present the research, I think, in a more kind of non-academic way. And I think podcasts like this is obviously a really good step towards that. And I think there are other ways we can be a bit more innovative around these things. So those two dual kind of ways forward is what I'm thinking.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Community education, especially to perhaps counter some of the rhetoric on law and order and community safety may make some impact. So now, Anna, I've taken up a lot of your time, but just before you go, the traditional New Books Network last question, what are you working on now?
Quite a few things, which is, I think, what would tend to be the case. So I did a previous project, a big comparative project between Australia and Norway and looking at prisons and why they work or don't work and the differences and so on. And I'm still writing up things from that. So I'm writing a current one looking at the roles of uniforms and clothes in prison. For example, in Norway, prisoners don't wear prison uniforms, they wear their own clothes. And some prison staff don't wear uniforms, they have their own clothes because it's low security. And it's interesting how that impacts, you know, identity and interaction and all that kind of stuff. I'm also working on a new research project that's funded by the Australian Research Council on what I call social infrastructure in prisons. This is it basically explores the way staff and prisoners interact and how innovations in the prison environment can support positive and respectful human connections with the aim of both reducing the harm of imprisonment, but also better post-release outcomes So that will be for the next few years. And the final major thing is around justice involved veterans. And this work I do with colleagues in the UK, Germany, and Canada. We're going to increase the presence here in Australia. So this is based on this former military, former service personnel, who either end up working in the prison or being prisoners themselves because of failures, basically, of transition out of the military. So it's kind of looking at total institutions and how people move in between them in different spaces. So those are the main kind of three things. And then always small bits and pieces here and there for fun, you know.
Well, coming from a law perspective, the criminological research that you're doing sounds really fascinating and a sort of great way to get your hands dirty and get into the field and actually make practical, meaningful changes. So I'll really look forward to reading about that. Now, just to wrap up, I'm Jane Richards and I've been speaking with Associate Professor Anna Erickson. She's a co-editor of a book called Neurodisability and the Criminal Justice System, Comparative Therapeutic Responses. It was published by Edward Elgar Publishing in 2021. This is New Books in Law, a channel on the New Books Network. Anna Erickson, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Jane. I really enjoyed that. Thanks.
The pleasure's all at mine.